You know, every now and then a story comes along that sounds like it belongs in a movie, except it's real. And it's been happening for decades, quietly in one of the least likely places you'd ever look for World War II combat aircraft. I'm Taildragger, this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today I want to tell you about the airplanes at the bottom of Lake Michigan. Pull up a chair for this one. In 1942, the United States Navy had a problem, a big one. They needed to train thousands of carrier pilots, and they needed to do it fast, but the Atlantic and Pacific coasts were vulnerable to German U-boats and Japanese submarines. You couldn't exactly park a training carrier off the coast of Virginia and hope nobody noticed, so the Navy did something that sounds a little crazy. They took two old sidewheel excursion steamers, the kind that used to haul passengers on the Great Lakes for weekend cruises, and they converted them into aircraft carriers. The USS Wolverine and the USS Sable, flat tops on fresh water right there on Lake Michigan, operating out of Navy Pier in Chicago. Now picture this, you're a 19-year-old kid from Iowa, you've got maybe 200 hours of flight time, most of it in a Sturman biplane, and now they want you to land a Grumman Wildcat on the back end of a converted steamboat that's doing about 12 knots in a crosswind on choppy lake water. The deck is shorter than anything you've ever seen. There's no catapult for most of these operations. You're doing it on guts and a prayer. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So these young pilots are bouncing, boltering, and sometimes just plain missing the deck. Between 1942 and 1945, roughly 17,800 pilots qualified for carrier operations on those two ships. That's an astonishing number. But along the way, somewhere around 130 to 140 aircraft went into the lake. Wildcats, Hellcats, Corsairs, Avengers, Dauntlesses. They'd come in too low, catch a wave, miss a wire, stall on approach. The pilot would usually get fished out. The airplane would sink. And Lake Michigan, bless her cold heart, is a remarkable preservationist. The water down there is dark, it's cold, and it's fresh. No salt corrosion, no tropical marine growth eating through the aluminum. Those airplanes settled into the silt and the lake just held them. 40 feet down, 60 feet, some of them more than 100 feet below the surface. And there they sat. For decades. Now here's where it gets interesting. In the 1980s and 90s, the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola and a handful of private salvage teams started pulling these airplanes out. And what they found was remarkable. The airframes were in far better condition than anyone had a right to expect. Cold fresh water had done what no museum storage could match. Fabric was gone, sure, rubber seals had deteriorated, but the aluminum skins, the steel engine mounts, the structural forgings, many of them were still sound. One of the most famous recoveries is a Grumman FM-2 Wildcat, Bureau number 86581. She went into the lake in 1944 during a botched approach. Some young ensign walked away wet but alive. 40-odd years later, a dive team found her sitting upright on the lake bottom like she was parked on a ramp. Both wings still attached, landing gear still down from the approach. The propeller was bent from the impact, but the Wright Cyclone engine was largely intact. Getting her out was its own kind of adventure. You've got to rig lifting bags, stabilize the airframe so it doesn't tear apart during the ascent, coordinate with barges and cranes on the surface. The silt alone is treacherous, disturb it, and your visibility goes to zero. Divers are working by feel in water that's barely above freezing at those depths. They brought that Wildcat up dripping mud and lake water, set her on a barge, and she began a journey that would take years. First to a conservation facility where every panel was carefully documented, photographed, and cataloged, then the real work started. See, restoring a lake recovery is different from restoring a hangar queen or a desert wreck. Desert airplanes, the ones that sat in Arizona or the Sahara. They're dry, but the sun has baked every seal and every piece of rubber to powder. The heat cycles have stressed the metal. Lake airplanes have a different set of problems. Water intrusion into every cavity. Corrosion in places you can't see without disassembly, electrical systems that are completely destroyed. But the primary structure, the bones of the airplane, those tend to be surprisingly solid. The restoration teams start by completely disassembling the aircraft. Every rivet gets drilled out. Every skin panel comes off. The spars get inspected with dye penetrant and sometimes X-ray. You're looking for cracks, for intergranular corrosion, for any place where the metal has lost its integrity. The engine comes apart on a stand. Every bearing, every cylinder, every valve gets measured against the original Grumman or Wright engineering specs. And here's what gets me about these restorations. The people doing this work are chasing a ghost. They're trying to bring back not just an airplane, but a moment in time that Wildcat wasn't some war hero. She never saw combat. She was a training bird, one of hundreds. And the kid who ditched her probably went on to fly Hellcats off a real carrier in the Pacific 6 months later. But she represents something. She's a piece of the pipeline that fed the entire naval air war. The craftsmen who do this work are a breed apart. I've watched them at shops in places like New Smyrna Beach, Florida, and Aurora, Oregon. They'll spend 3 months making a single cowling panel. They'll machine a fitting from a billet of aluminum because the original part doesn't exist anymore and no drawing has survived. They'll track down a 92-year-old retired Grumman engineer to ask about a bracket that doesn't appear in any manual. And the paint. Lord, the paint. Getting the exact shade of navy blue-gray right is an obsession. They'll mix and test and hold samples up to photographs taken on the deck of the Wolverine in 1943, adjusting until the color matches what the camera and the sun and the Kodachrome film all conspired to record. Some of these lake recoveries have made it all the way back to airworthy status. There are Wildcats flying today that spent 40 years underwater. Think about that for a second. An airplane that a teenager ditched into Lake Michigan during the Roosevelt administration is now doing flybys at air shows with a $7,500-an-hour engine turning over smooth as glass, but not every recovery goes that way. Some airframes come up too far gone. The spar caps are corroded beyond limits, or a critical forging is cracked in a place that can't be repaired. Those airplanes become static displays, which is still a worthy fate. They go to museums where they tell the story with their scars still showing. Honestly, there's something powerful about seeing a Dauntless with lake silt still in the wheel wells, a placard explaining where she was found and what she was doing when she went in. One recovery that sticks with me is an SBD Dauntless, Bureau No. 10518. She was pulled from about 60 feet of water in the early 2000s. When Diverse first reached her, they found the rear gunner's seat still in position, the twin 30 caliber mount still pointed aft. The instrument panel was mostly intact behind a layer of sediment and scratched into the aluminum next to the compass. Someone, probably some young radioman gunner, had scratched his initials and a date. That little bit of graffiti connected this mass of corroded metal to a specific human being who sat in that seat and was probably scared to death of what was coming next. The research side of these restorations is its own rabbit hole. Teams cross-reference bureau numbers with Navy records to trace each aircraft's complete service history. They can tell you which training squadron operated her, which day she went in, sometimes even the name of the pilot. The National Archives in College Park, Maryland, has boxes of accident reports from those Lake Michigan operations, and reading them is like reading the diary of American naval aviation learning its trade the hard way. There's a report I read once where a lieutenant junior grade described his approach as, quote, normal until the deck came up faster than expected, end quote. That's pilot talk for I messed up and I'd rather not say how. His Hellcat caught the port catwalk, cartwheeled, and went over the side. He was rescued by the plane guard destroyer trailing behind the Sable. The airplane was logged as a Class A loss, and that was that. 60 years later, a dive team found her right where the coordinates said she'd be. The economics of these restorations are staggering. A full restoration of a Wildcat from lake recovery to airworthy condition can run well north of $1 million, sometimes pushing $2 million, an Avenger or a Corsair, even more. The engine alone can cost $300,000 to overhaul or replace. And these aren't investments in the traditional sense. Nobody's getting rich. The people who fund these projects are doing it because they believe that a flying airplane tells a story that a static display never can. The sound of a Wright R-1820 Cyclone at full power is not something you can simulate. You feel it in your chest. You smell the exhaust, that particular blend of avgas and hot oil that every radial engine produces. And when that Wildcat breaks ground and climbs away from the runway, you're watching 1943 happen again right in front of you. Now I should mention that the lake hasn't given up all her secrets. There are still dozens of airframes down there. The cold, dark water protects them, but it also hides them. Side-scan sonar surveys have located many, but some remain unrecovered because of depth, condition, or funding. There's an ongoing conversation between preservationists, the Navy, and the state of Illinois about how to manage what's essentially an underwater museum. Some argue the planes should stay where they are, that the lake is the most stable environment for long-term preservation. Others say the clock is ticking and that even cold, fresh water will eventually win the war against aluminum. Both sides have a point, but I'll tell you this, every time I see one of those Lake Michigan birds at an air show, engine rumbling, prop spinning, I'm glad somebody pulled her out. Because that airplane was built to fly, she was built to train a young man to land on a moving ship in the middle of an ocean war. Sitting on the bottom of a lake is dignified, but it's not what she was made for. The USS Wolverine and USS Sable themselves are gone now. The Wolverine was scrapped in 1947. The Sable followed a year later, two ships that trained nearly 18,000 naval aviators, and we cut them up for scrap metal before the decade was out, but the airplanes they sent to the bottom are coming back one by one, dripping mud in history. If you ever get the chance to visit the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, they have several Lake Michigan recoveries on display. Or, if you're at a Warbird show and you see a Wildcat or a Hellcat with a placard mentioning Lake Michigan, go take a closer look. Run your eyes along those rivet lines. Think about the 18-year-old who rowed her down into the water. Think about the diver who found her 50 years later. Think about the craftsman who spent 2 years bringing her back. That airplane has a story that covers three generations, and every chapter matters. Most of what I share today comes from the research of A.D. Baker III and his work documenting these recoveries, along with the excellent records maintained by the National Naval Aviation Museum. If you want to dig deeper, the book Operation Freshwater by the Naval Aviation Museum Foundation is a great place to start. Find us at RadioHanger.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down.